Yes, once again, due to a combination of events, it's the Justin Innes show, and I have the lesson as well. Kind of just all came together that way. Like it seems to every so often, I think it must be the will of God that this sometimes seems to happen, that it all spins together, and then I end up with, strangely enough, everything it seems like at the same time. Tim did let me know this afternoon. He said, wow, really feeling a lot worse, so can you cover for me? Absolutely. So I have been the backup for a while, and I do usually keep some lessons in reserve just for this. Jorge's nodding his head up and down because he's probably familiar with having done the same exact thing. This evening, I want to talk about a few of these moments in a particular chapter in Matthew that are like snapshots of a few moments in time in Jesus's life. We end up with these stories linked together. What we'll see is that they do go together. There's this common thing that goes through all of them, and yet they sometimes seem like separate instances. I want to talk tonight about Matthew 14. Matthew 14. Eventually, of course, this is going to link into the passage that was at the top of the song we just sang, Love Lifted Me. We're going to be talking at the end here, near the end of chapter 14. We're going to talk about, of course, Peter being lifted up. Love lifted me. I was deep in sin. What lifted me? Love lifted me. And of course, Jesus himself is who's the one who's going to lift up Peter in that story. But let's back up and start at the beginning of the chapter. At that time, this is verse 1 of Matthew 14. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard about the fame of Jesus. And he said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He has been raised from the dead. That is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. This is not Herod the Great, is it? This is not the Herod who put to death a bunch of kids trying to find Jesus many years before. This is a later Herod. We had a whole bunch of Herods in a row. There's multiple Herods in like the same family. So this is one of those Herods. But he, like all the Herods in the Bible, seems to be not an especially nice individual. It seems like the term Herod in the Bible is like the term Jezebel. You wouldn't want to name your kid Herod. Not to mention the fact that it would just sound a little weird in our current environment, I suppose. But Herod the Tetrarch is the ruler. He's like he's not the king, but he's ruling on behalf of Rome in this area at the time. And he says to his servants, this is John the Baptist. Why does he say that John the Baptist has been raised from the dead? Well, Herod himself knew John and had talked to him personally. He knew who John was, and they'd had conversations, which we're going to find out here in just a minute. It says, for Herod had seized John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had been saying to him, it is not lawful for you to have her. Now, we need to stop right there, and we have to understand that a few things about John from this passage. We might have a view of John as being this irrelevant, unwashed, long-haired, hippie guy on the street corner with a piece of cardboard, not cardboard then, but you know the type, the one that is shouting crazy stuff and that can be easily ignored. But if he was easily ignored, Herod would have ignored him. John had some influence. He had some followers. There was a little bit of politics going on. And he was saying it's not right that the ruler of this country has his brother's wife, which is what had happened here. And so Herod decides he's going to do something about that, and he has John put in prison. Now it says he wanted to put him to death, but he feared the people because they held him to be a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before the company and pleased Herod, so that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Prompted by her mother, she said, give the head of John the Baptist here on a platter. Very famous request. Sometimes you'll hear it said at work, this guy's going to ask for that person's head on a platter. Well, this is the source of that particular image. A terrible image, a crazy image, isn't it? I would like John the Baptist's head here on a platter. Now it says the king was sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he commanded it to be given. In another passage on this, we find out why Herod was sorry, don't we? because Herod has started to talk to John and kind of was interested in what John had to say. He found John to be an interesting person. And so Herodias, though, wants him eliminated. We have a lot of very thorny, sticky politics going on here. Some of the people in my class will be interested to know that the daughter that's referenced here is named Salome. We went through a Salome Alexandra. That is not the daughter, that's not the Salome talked about here, but rather like a grand, great, great, great grand aunt back a bunch of generations. But the name Salome was kind of a common name in that time because of Salome Alexandra and the fact that she had been a very famous ruler for a short time. And so it says here that the king was sorry. He was sorry because he'd started to like John. He'd started to be interested in John. He would go talk to John, and John would keep trying to talk him into this. But you'll notice that Herodias is the one that puts her up to it. So it's not as though he took this kind of passive wallflower lady. No, they're in on it together. And Herodias is like, hey, we need to get rid of this John guy because he's a thorn in my side. The people are maybe taking John to be a prophet. Not only that, a little bit of the rabble is getting roused here. Otherwise, Herod and Herodias would not care about this. If John was silenced, if he couldn't be heard, if he wasn't causing issues in the society, but the society, there's a part of it that is listening to John that does pay attention to what he says. But anyway, because of his oaths and his guests, in front of everyone, he had said, I will give you anything that you want. He does send and command that John be beheaded in prison. Now, I want you to look at this part here, right around verse 12. It says, he sent and had, this is a beautiful passage. He sent and had John beheaded in prison, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And this is one of those nice little literary devices, because we're about to hop back in and talk about Jesus, but we need to travel to Jesus, don't we? So we see what the gospel writer does. The head goes to her mother. But where does the body go? It says his disciples, that's John's disciples, came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. So look at the literary device there. Look at what happens. John is beheaded. His head is taken, given to Salome on a platter, presumably. What a horrifying thing to do. And then off that goes to her mom with the head on a platter. And then John's disciples come, and they get his body, and they take the body to Jesus. And now we shift to Jesus in the story, don't we? That's been the kind of literary device that has taken us and shifted the focus a little bit, and now Matthew wants to talk about Jesus. They come, and they tell Jesus, and it says, when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. The Gospels, when they do things like this, are similar to the book of Genesis, in the fact that we're just told that he goes in a boat by himself. We're told that he seeks a desolate place. We're not really told what's going through Jesus' head. I've heard a lot of sermons on this that he was worried for himself. I don't think that's true. There's sermons that he was sad about John. I don't know about that either. But I will say that it just says he was trying to get away from the crowds at this point. So one thing that we can say is that he said, well, at this moment in time, I'd like to be alone. And as often happens when Jesus, when he tries to be alone, he's not going to get his wish because the people are going to hunt him down. They're going to find him. This might have been, if you think about it, a little bit of the constant temptation that the devil has for him. We as humans sometimes need time alone. We need time, especially when there's tragedy in our family, when there's something that we have to think about, to turn on in our heads. That's a time when we want to be alone, isn't it? And we want to be away from people. And so Jesus seeks to be alone and away from people so he can maybe dwell on this, think about what he's going to do. We aren't told what he's thinking of, what he's doing. He's probably praying fervently, but he's not allowed to get alone. No, no, no. The crowds are going to find him. They're going to seek him out. And because he's Jesus, he's going to do something about it. When the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now when it was evening, the disciples came to him, and they said, this is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves. But Jesus said, they need not go away. Now it's interesting. Stop and think here. What is going on? Right at this point in the story, The disciples, maybe they understand that their master tried to get away from it all. Maybe part of the reason why they come to him, pure conjecture on my part, but maybe one of the reasons they come to him and they say, send those crowds away. Send them away to get food. You were trying to be by yourself. You're trying to get away from it all. You're our leader. You can do that. Send them away. But Jesus doesn't send them away yet. Not yet. He has something else that he has to do. They need not go away. You give them something to eat. I love this passage because I can connect so firmly with the disciples at that moment in time. At that moment in time, it's like I went and told my boss. You know, they had to find him intimidating. He's Jesus. They've seen him do so many amazing things. He's already been healing here. There's been miracles that are talked about right in front of him. And he doesn't say to them, they don't have to go away. I can take care of this. I've been doing miracles for the rest of the day. No, he doesn't actually say that. He says, you feed them. Now, at that moment in time, I would be a little put out. I am not a miracle worker, right? So I would think, well, what am I going to do about that? Is he crazy? You know, I don't understand what he's talking about. He wants me to feed these people? And that's what they say. They're like, We don't have anything. We have 5 loaves here and 2 fish. So that's like, what is that? That's one person's lunch, right? 5 loaves, 2 fish, little tiny, I don't know, maybe they were, even if they're huge loaves, this is not going to feed a lot of people. You got 5,000 people. Now, I haven't been around 5,000 people very often, but I do remember there was a couple of times when we were at Yosemite Family Encampment many years ago in the 80s when they would tell us, we did a count, and there's like 5,000 people in what they called church bowl. Okay, I don't know if some of you are nodding, you've been there. And it's like you look across and there's people spread, and you can't even see where they're all going. There's this little part in church bowl that actually has pews. And when I was a kid, I remember I never saw the pews, because we never got anywhere near the pews. The pews were always where, like, I think we just let the people who needed the pews go up there. But there weren't that many pews anyway. I think there was less seating pews-wise than there is in this building. And so people would sit everywhere. You were spread out across the side of this mountain. And 5,000 people is a lot of people. And in that place, it must have been a similar type of situation. The disciples look up in horror. They look around them. There's people everywhere. Okay, there's people all over the place, and they have 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus said, feed these people. He didn't say, I'm going to feed these people. Now he is saying, I'm going to feed these people, and you need to trust me to do it. But he tells them, you feed these people. All right, so he says, we have these 5 loaves and 2 fish. And the way they tell him this must have been not, hey, yay, Lord, you can do this. It must have been like, are you crazy? There's 5 loaves and 2 fish here. There's not enough. There's not enough even for us 12 people to eat this. We're done. We need to go. We're all hungry. There's grumbling in the tummies. And you were trying to be by yourself anyway, Lord. Why not just let it happen? Send people away. But he says, bring them here to me. Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass, and he says he takes the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and he looks up to heaven and said a blessing. And then he breaks the loaves. It says he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds, and they all ate and were satisfied. Now imagine what that was like. Imagine what that miracle was like when it actually was happening in front of you. Imagine being one of the 12. Imagine being Peter and going, okay, I got a plate of food. I don't know what they did for plates. You know, you were wondering about that. Anyway, so Peter comes in and he says, hey, here you go. They don't have plates. He's like, give me some loaves and fishes. And he takes them and he walks out and he finds a family and they're sitting there and he says, here you go. And they're splitting them up. And then he walks back and he gets maybe another 5 loaves and 2 fish. You almost wonder if 5 loaves and 2 fish was how much they could carry, because they may have carried it like every time, right? They're pulling it back. And every time he goes back, he must have thought, imagine you're going back again, you're thinking, this is crazy. I would almost want to watch Jesus right there. I'd want to stop. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I really liked watching on TV. I liked watching Doug Henning, right? And you know, the magician, sleight of hand. And I'm trying to figure out what on earth he was doing. So you almost wonder if it was like a sleight of hand, like you'd want to stop and watch Jesus when he broke those loaves and there was not supposed to be anything left. And he hands them to you. Why is that? When he reaches down again, there's something else there. Okay, why is that? And you want to watch that, but instead you're busy taking food out to the crowd as it just goes on and on. Now notice here that it doesn't say that they were all fasting, but they had a little bit of food. It doesn't say here that they were not satisfied. It says they all ate and they were satisfied. They all ate and they were full. They ate and they were like, oh, no more fish and loaves for me. Oh, wow, that was good. It's nap time now. It's sleep time. You know, that's amazing. I mean, they all ate and they were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets. We're very, very modern. So we're not really into this whole numerology stuff, right? But you notice that you had 5 loaves and 2 fish, which makes 7. And then you'll notice that they collected 12, right? So there's a reason for that. And that's kind of, you see that a lot, all right? Especially when you look through like Revelation, or you look through a lot of areas where numbers become very important and interesting, and you end up with the number 7 and the number 12 quite a bit, don't you, right? The 144,000 is 12 times 12 times 1,000. You end up with 12s and 7s, though, even within our own calendar today. We've talked about this some in my class a few times. I mean, you might think this is some ancient, weird, thing from the past that they were maybe interested in and God was kind of humoring for them, but there's something inextricably bound to 7s and 12s within the entire machinery of nature somehow. I mean, we have these 7-day weeks, we have 12 months of the year, we have all these things that are locked into these numbers, which is very, very kind of strange. One day it would be interesting to do a long numerology class, I suppose. That is not today. But in any case, you end up with 7s and 12s showing up. They collect 12 basketfuls at the end of this day. And people are so full, they can't eat anymore. Now, these aren't people necessarily that are used to being full, but here they've eaten as much as they can, and they are absolutely stuffed by 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Absolutely amazing. They took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over, and those who ate were about 5,000 men besides women and children. How many people were there? Were there 10,000 people there on that mountain? It's unbelievable. And he feeds all of them right in front of them. Now it says, going on, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. Kind of once again, put yourself there at that mountain. Jesus says, why don't you guys go on? I'll take care of the crowds. Now, this is the same Jesus who was himself trying to be by himself before, but he's dismissing the crowds. Now, it takes a long time, especially if you just fed all of them and you taught them and you did a bunch of other stuff, to dismiss thousands of people. There's probably a lot of folks that wanted to talk to Jesus. So, you know, they're coming and he's dismissing them. It's not a, hey, y'all, get out of here type of thing. It takes a while. And so in that time, the disciples have gotten out, they've gotten on the boat and they've taken off, okay? And he has finally a little bit of time to himself. It says, after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now, finally, he gets a little bit of time to himself. And in this case, as opposed to the previous passage, we're told that Jesus is actually praying. We're told why he's seeking this time to himself, right? He is now going up on the mountain to pray by himself. When evening came, he was there alone. So he has this time, and he's finally there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. So this is one of the great, there's so many of the great passages right here squeezed into Matthew 14, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about it this evening. We have feeding the 5,000, we have heads on platters, we have walking on water, all in one passage, all in one chapter, all in one section of narrative. It says that he's walking on water. Now, there's a strange thing that goes on here where they're terrified. They say, it's a ghost, and they cry out in fear. We kind of say, well, why would they think that? Well, it's nighttime, for one thing. But the other thing is, and I've wondered about this a long time, how big were those swells? I don't know. So, years ago, my company, we took a little trip. We went to Catalina Island on a holiday trip. And when we were at Catalina, the first day was beautiful. It was just gorgeous. And at the end of the first day, though, it was looking a little stormy. And the next day, we woke up, and in the lobby of the hotel we were at, there was a lot of activity. And people were like, "We've been trying to reach you, Justin. We've got to do something. We've got to get out of here now." And it's like, "Well, why?" And they said, "Because this island is emptying out." And they said, "You need to go outside and take a look at it." And I walk outside, and it's pouring rain. And you can see the ocean's just like this out there. And this is not the ocean. But I'll never forget, Elena and I, we walk down the little U there at Catalina from the one side to the other, and we go to the place where everybody is trying to line up and get ready, and all the people got their luggage, and half the island's there, and it's kind of a stressful experience, and we happen to be standing way at the back, and the guy says, "Well, you can kind of see the boat coming," and I look up, and I can see this big swell, and I see this boat going down one side, and it disappears. And then I see it come off the other side and down the side and disappears. And then right about then, the guy says, he says, "What's that?" And hear him on the radio. And he says, "Oh, they're taking on water," which is not something that I ever wanted to hear about a boat that I was going to go on in my entire life. Now, it turns out not to be that big a deal, I guess, but I am not a boat guy. So for me, taking on water was not a good thing. And so we decided to stay another night, and we got this kind of stranded rate, which was really good. That was really nice. But I remember the fact that the boat would disappear every time, that you couldn't see it, that these swells would obscure things. So I don't know, maybe Jesus is walking, and sometimes they can see him, and now he's down below the swell, and sometimes he's up on the swell, or they're up on the swell, and they're, "What is that? Is that a person out there walking on the water?" You would think it was a ghost, too. Let's just be honest, you would not say, "Yo, it's Jesus." I mean, you wouldn't, okay? Now, even though you've had the feeding of the 5,000 and all right, still, that's kind of crazy, okay? And they say that sailors and stuff are always, are always very superstitious. I don't know if that's part of it, too, but they were like, "Oh, it's a ghost, okay? So, but Jesus says, no, take heart, it is I, don't be afraid, all right? Don't be afraid, don't be scared. So, I love what Peter says here, everybody does. This is one of the great Peter passages of all time. Compressed into one area, like we oftentimes see with Peter, is Peter's glory and Peter's shame, all in one particular passage. You might notice that this happens quite a bit. Now, some of it supposedly, the ancients actually noticed this. Right after the Bible was written, there were people that were already commenting on the fact that sections about Peter were sometimes sandwiched good and bad side by side. And in fact, one of the early guys was explaining that. I think it might have been Eusebius, who says, "Well, sure, because Peter had to do with Mark's gospel, and he told the story. And so when he told something good about himself, he would tell something bad about himself." And I don't know if that's true or not. But if you think about it, it does kind of happen every so often, doesn't it? Like the passage where he says, "Well, who do you say I am?" "Well, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God." "Well, oh, great, you're Peter. Now you get to be Pope." Well, at least that's what the Catholics say, right? So, but no, you're Peter. "This rock will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not be..." And you didn't get this from man. Oh, it's a real high point for Peter there, a real high point. And then in Mark, it's verses later, it's right next to it, it's shoved up right next to it, where Peter's like, Jesus is telling him, "I'm going to die, and everything's going to go like this." And Peter says, "That's not going to happen to you, Lord." He's like, "Get behind me, Satan." So he goes from, "Hey, revealed by God," to, "Get behind me, Satan." And so even many thousands of years ago, several thousand years ago, after this was written down, people looked at him at this and said, "Wow, Peter's stuff goes this way sometimes in the Gospels." And they were explaining it by the fact that he himself had told the story, which I don't know if that's true. I tell you that because I find it fun. I like the idea that Peter might have been that type of self-effacing guy who might have said, "Look, here's a story about me that you may have heard," because he must have been quite a colorful fellow, And he said, "Here's a story. Let's tell you about when I said that he was Christ, the Son of Living God," which is a real high point for me. But then I'm going to follow that up with the time when he said I was Satan and I should get behind him, right? So he keeps himself balanced in here. Usually you get a good and a bad. And here in this one story, we get a little bit of both with Peter, right? Not really a bad, though, but really we get kind of a balance that happens here. And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." It's a beautiful statement, isn't it? He says it just perfect. He doesn't say, "Lord, if it's you, I'll come to you on the water." Me. No, he says, "You command me to come to you on the water, and I'll obey." and then it will go like this, right? It will go good, and everything will go exactly how I want it to go, and things will be good for me. And so Jesus says, come. And I always imagine that Jesus says it with a smirk on his face. Okay. You want to? I mean, he's climbing swells. I don't know what that feels like, right? You know, when you see you watch a show and somebody walks on water, it's always because they put a little bit of water and there's like a platform underneath and he's splashing. I don't think Jesus is splashing, though. I think that water's like hard for him, right? Or tacky or something like that, right? So anyway, he's on the surface of the water walking. And so he says, yeah, come. Now, the beautiful thing about Peter is that he gets out of the boat and he goes. That's just an amazing thing. Would you do that? None of the other disciples do this. I've had people point this out many times. And I think, you know, I know that this is maybe a repetitive sermon for you and everything, but I love this passage so much. And it's fun to drill into because every last little piece of it like this is fascinating. None of the other disciples look at him and say, hey, he's doing that. Hey, us too. Right? I mean, you think you might do that. If I see Peter take a few steps, I might go, I want to come. You know, because what a thing to miss. Do you ever have those times in your life when you say to yourself, oh, you're with some friends, and I was like this. I was kind of a timid kid, and so I had some friends, and one of them would go do something that I wish I could have done. I think, man, I wish I'd spoken up and done that, you know, and maybe that's maybe what some of them are thinking right now. They're like, he's able to walk on water. I wish I could walk on water. That's pretty cool. Okay, it's not every day you get to walk on water. I like the fact that somebody one time said, you know, it's almost like a trick question. Was Jesus the only person who ever walked on water? Well, no, he wasn't. Peter also walked on water, but he didn't walk for a super long time, maybe. Or maybe he did. If you think about it, the distance is kind of left out here in this passage, isn't it? So it says here, he gets out of the boat, walks on the water, and depending on, you know, your translation's going to struggle with this one a little bit, maybe. The ESV says, and he came to Jesus. Now, what's that mean, right? So is he halfway there? Did he make it a few steps like a baby? And then he was like, you know, no, it sounds like he was walking pretty good as long as Jesus was out there. And then it says he came to Jesus, and it says, but when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, something happens to him, right? So this is a strange, strange thing. Imagine, if you will, what is happening here, not this time from the angle like I usually do it, from the apostle's viewpoint, from Peter's viewpoint. Imagine what is happening from God's viewpoint, all right? Just imagine for a minute that you are the being that spoke the universe into existence, all right? That much power. And you're out there, and you're walking on the water. You almost wonder if Jesus does this, you know, like as a, like it's part of this path. It's built, I think Laurel said one time, it's like this, some of these passages are clearly, he's doing this thing because it will be written down, because we will read about it, because we will see these things, right? And we will discuss them, and we will understand certain things about him because of it. And so when Peter, it says, saw the wind and the waves, it says, he was afraid. It says he began to sink. Now understand that if you're God, you don't have to let him sink. Do you understand what I'm saying there? You don't have to let him sink. You don't have to. You can make him afraid, and he can fall down on all fours and crawl on the hard water all the way to Jesus, okay? I mean, you can leave the water hard. You are God. You are making the water hard for this, all right? Understand that, okay? So this is done for Peter. This is done for Peter. All right? This is done for you because it was written for you, but I think it's also done for Peter because when Peter looks around and starts getting scared, God kind of goes, okay, right? And he kind of lets him start to sink. He lets him start to sink. People have pointed out the fact that, you know, you don't usually start to sink in water. You usually go, whoom, right? So Peter's like, start, it's like, okay, which is interesting to me because I would say to myself, you know what? My fear is making, but it's weird, right? I mean, like starting to sink, like, you know, like not right in the water, okay? And so he says he starts to sink, and then he cries out. And I used to remember as a kid, one of my favorite preachers of all time was Jack Exum. How many of you have ever heard Jack Exum do this passage? Yeah. I love this passage. When I was a kid, I would listen to Jack Exum. I remember when we were We were a Yosemite family encampment one time, and when I was in high school, I was like a lot of high school, and I would hang out with my friends, and sometimes we wouldn't pay attention very well. And, you know, I'm sorry, Mom, Dad. But when Jackie Exum came on one time, I remember somebody's talking to one of my friends, and one of my friends says, "Be quiet, be quiet. Jackie Exum's talking, right?" I mean, that's the way Exum was. We all wanted to listen to Exum, right? I mean, it was crazy. The guy had the most amazing ability to draw word pictures. It was just absolutely incredible. And he said when he got to this, it always used to crack me up. He would say, "This was no Alabama prayer, Our Father." And it would just crack me up, right? He's like, "Lord, save me right now. Save me. Lord, save me. Lord, save me." Throws out his hand. And Jesus is right there. Immediately he says, he reached out his hand and took hold of him. But he says this to him. He says, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Why did you doubt? You see, because like I said before, Jesus could have left that water hard. He could have been watching him as Peter crawls now, right? That's how I picture it, right? Like you would, if you were on a tightrope or something, be down like this. Maybe, you know, have you ever done that where you look down, okay? Like you're on a place. I have a fear of heights. So if I'm on some place and as long as I'm looking across, people say, "Don't look down." And the second they say that, you look down. So you look down and now you can't hardly move, okay? So I feel like in a way that's kind of what happened to Peter. He now looks down and now he's frozen, right? And he's scared and he loses his faith. And because of that, Jesus, God, allows him not to sink instantaneously, not to suddenly become how many weight he is and then fall in the water, but rather God says, "Okay, Peter," and he starts doing this with him, right? I mean, the water's still viscous somehow, who knows? Physics is still being played with here. There's still laws that are in serious violation, right, that are going on. What is happening is Peter slowly starts to sing. He says, "Lord, save me." And Jesus says, "You know, why did you doubt? Why did you doubt? Because the first step you took. The first step, you made it. The first step, you did fine. The second step, you did fine. Who knows how many steps? You did fine. Maybe Peter walked 5 whole swells. Maybe he walked a half mile through the night to go to Jesus. We have no idea. But then right at the end is when he loses it. But Jesus still reaches out his hand. Just like the song says, "I was sinking deep in sin and love lifted me." Jesus reaches out his hand and he saves him. He says, "Oh, you little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." And just like we said, this entire passage was done for them, and it was done so it would be written down for you, specifically so that we could learn from this passage the way that our Lord works, the way that faith works, the way that we should think of him, the way that we should understand him. A little bit difficult for us. When I was a kid, I used to try to walk on water. I remember that every year the pool would open. And I would think, "I wonder if I pray hard enough if he'll let me walk on water. Just a little bit. Just like one or two steps. I don't, it doesn't have to be long, right? And then I'll be okay." I would think this. I don't know. Little kids think strange things, right? So it never worked. I would try to get a running start and hope that maybe it would work that way. But it didn't, okay? But so we might say to ourselves, "Well, we live in a time that's not miraculous, Justin. Then, you know, he's got Jesus in front of him, so who, you know, other people might have gotten out of the boat, and you could have done all sorts of crazy stuff. But now we don't live in a time like that. But yet this is written down for us, and this is written down for people who barely a generation later are not going to see miracles like this in front of themselves. And so these people are going to be told, trust in Jesus who can do these things. Trust in a Jesus who is capable of this. Trust in Jesus who can walk on water and who is alive. Not who has raised up and kind of is gone. I mean, he's alive. He's alive. If he wants to be here, he can be here. All right? Someday he will be here." In the song we sang right before this, we sang, "Love Lifted Me." Right? As I said, the top of that song is, in fact, "He was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried, 'Lord, save me,' and immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand." And the imagery in this song is all about that passage, isn't it? "I was sinking deep in sin, far from the peaceful shore, very deeply stained within, sinking to rise no more. But the master of the sea heard my despairing cry, from the waters lifted me, now safe am I. All my heart to him I give, ever to him I cling. In his blessed presence live, ever his praises sing. Love so mighty and so true merits my soul's best songs. Faithful loving service to him belongs. Souls in danger, this is the wider audience now. Souls in danger, look above. Jesus completely saves. He will lift you by his love out of the angry waves. He's the master of the sea. Billows his will obey. He, your Savior, wants to be saved today. I've kind of inverted the songs a little bit. You'll notice that this song, Love Lifted Me, I haven't heard it used that way often, but it could have been used as an invitation song because the third verse says, it's speaking to the wider audience. It's saying to people, you are also sinking in sin. You are dropping down slowly. It's a sin that you could sink in fast, but you're sinking slow. And you should throw out your hand to Jesus and look for his help. Now, we might almost get a little sinner prayers-ish here, though, right? Oh, what are you saying there, Justin? Just, Lord Jesus, save me? Is that really what's going on? No, and that's why we're going to sing this song in just a moment here, which is 164. We're going to sing 164 in just a few minutes, and that's going to be my invitation song, all right? 164 is typically what? A communion song, okay? But I want you, when you're singing it, to see it more as an invitation song. The real way that Jesus stops us from sinking now is by the act that he took when he was here. He stops you from sinking into sin by throwing yourself onto his cross, by being saved through his blood, through the sacrifice that was made there, the depth and the riches of God's saving grace. This song, so I was sinking deep in sin, far from me, love lifted me. Love, what kind of love? The love that's going to be talked about in this second song, the depth of God's love. And what kind of depth of God's love? The depth and the riches of God's saving grace flowing down from the cross for me. There the debt for my sins by the Savior was paid in his suffering on Calvary. So this is the kind of love that Jesus had for us, and this is the kind of love that he demonstrates for each and every one of you. You can't get out of the boat and walk on water, but you can get out of your pew and come to him and be saved. If you need to do that, would you do that now as we stand and sing this song? Number 164.